Accession number 30018, reel 5.
John Farley, reel 5. How much cooperation did you have with other NATO air forces while you were in Germany?
I wasn't aware of a great deal. I'm quite sure that the sort of the commanders at station and squadron level might have had a bit more contact with them. We occasionally would go to somebody else's airfield and operate from there for a week or so. Boda up in the Arctic Circle, we took 4 airplanes and operated from Boda for a week. That was quite an experience because it was a long way up, and the scenery was unbelievably spectacular, the whole of Norway and so on. And I remember another bunch went off and operated with the Danish Air Force, the Danish Air Force at Karup. And I can remember that because I can remember in the ops room the very difficult telephone communications between the two bases, and the flight commander shouting, "Karup! Karup!" you know, into some squawk box, and trying to, you know, you couldn't understand what was being said. So NATO was a bit primitive in those days. I don't think we had, it had established much in the way of complex communications and effective communications in the way that it has now. So the cooperation was only just being thought about, really.
And how much cooperation with other squadrons within the RAF in Germany?
Competition more than cooperation, I think. You're always trying to make your squadron... I mean, it's... My overriding impression of looking back on the Air Force in those days was how competitive life was. I was competing with the other pilots on the squadron. My squadron was competing with the other squadrons on the station. My station was competing with the other stations that flew similar aeroplanes. And it was all about, we're better than you are. This slightly childish, immature, you know, seeing no good in your other mates, etc., etc. But as I tried to suggest earlier, that's not a criticism. I'm quite sure that was the only possible military culture that was going to produce any results in those days, because you were totally dependent on the individuals doing an exceptional job. It wasn't that the individuals were part of a total system that included equipment, and the individuals are there merely sort of making the most out of the equipment, and the whole equipment scene just achieves the objective, you know, which is how modern warfare tends to be. Unless, of course, you're in the army, when you're still going to walk about and get shot at. But you know what I'm getting at, I'm sure. So it was a remarkably untechnical sort of culture, in my view. It was the I'm better than you are culture.
And obviously you mentioned one of your roles with the maintenance of the aircraft and that. How large was the squadron's ground force, and what was it composed of?
Well, you had half a dozen senior NCOs who were the lifeblood of the squadron, and you had 70 or 80 airmen, you know, who operated the spanners in the hangar, basically. Again, I don't think they were educated to anything like the extent that their equivalent colleagues are today. Although, in fact, today, to be honest, I mean, for example, where I went up to this RAF Linton flying for anything, it's contractorised now. I mean, on a UK home base, there are civilians servicing the aeroplanes. But in Germany, no, we didn't have any civilians. I keep repeating myself, but it was a different world then, and it's not meant to be criticism, it was how it was. And the senior NCOs were very important because they had the pretty rough, bullying-type man management skills that were expected of NCOs in the services. You didn't say, "Oh, come on, chaps, that's not very good," you know. you were an effing this or a being that, and, you know, get your bloody arse in gear, and or I'll have you on jankers type of thing, which today would not be tolerated, at least not to anything like the same extent, certainly not in the Air Force or the Navy, and quite rightly so, because the individuals you're dealing with are much higher quality and don't need to be treated like that. But, I mean, the chaps that I flew aeroplanes with after the Second World War in the 50s, I mean, they joined the Air Force because it was better than working for a living, basically. I mean, that's not an exaggeration, you know. They just saw it as a wonderful flying club, you know. And so they were blokes who needed to be stamped on a lot of the time, or they were just going to get nowhere, you know. Air crew and ground crew.
Servicing, you mentioned that there were problems with those, the aircraft of the time in servicing. Was there any servicing problems specifically to the Hunter that you can remember that were...
I suppose the simple answer to that is no, so far as the flying machine was concerned, but yes, so far as the electrics were concerned. The hydraulics weren't bad, the fuel system wasn't bad, but the electrics were extremely unreliable. And if we fired all four guns, and normally in training we only fired one or two, the level of vibration was so great that it would normally put on a red nose wheel light, and sometimes the red nose wheel will actually fall down, and so on. The electrics, it was all plugs and sockets. This was the problem. Poor connections and radios failing. I mean, our only communication was a thing called a 10-channel radio, and it had literally 10 channels and a big rotating knob, and you went A, B, C, D, E, and you had set 1 and set 2. And set 2 would be KLMN or something, you know. And, you know, it was very primitive stuff. And when you took one of these boxes out, whether the plug and the socket that connected it back in had a high resistance or a pin got pushed over, I mean, these were the sort of issues. Electrics were considered to be unreliable things in the 1950s. We hadn't got to avionics. Well, that's a slight exaggeration. We had a thing called a radar gun sight towards the end of my tour, which, of course, had got a degree of what we would call electronics in it now. But it was just a box that was screwed in, and it either worked or it didn't. And if it didn't, everybody would scratch their head and say, well, newfangled stuff, you know, rubbish. So, this great advancing technology of what was fitted in aeroplanes didn't happen until I was in the industry and doing test flight.
You mentioned there obviously the radio sets and things that you had. What about communication in the air? What did that involve? Would there be much communication, or would you keep it very brief? Would there be a discipline that goes with that?
Well, tremendous discipline in RT. You didn't say anything unless you had to. And when you said it, it had to be clear and concise and correct and at the right moment, this business of calling another enemy, another target or trail and so on. No, you didn't chatter on the RT, you shut up. And no. The RT was kept quiet because it was the only way that we could get any information into ourselves from the ground controller or from station level. The quality of the radio transmissions, the intelligibility of them, the static, the noise, the say again your garbled message, you know, sort of thing will likely be the response, because the quality of the radios was poor, just in terms of intelligibility. They were VHF. It was only when we got UHF, very high frequency as opposed to ultra high frequency, that we started to get this clarity of sound. I mean, some youngsters will still remember analog radios and analog portable voice recorders or something, and MF radios and long wave and medium wave radios compared to VHF, and the difference was black and white, wasn't it? And was exactly the same when the Air Force went from VHF to UHF. If you were going to some other base, you mentioned flying from other bases, The first thing he had to do was to get some crystals that were appropriate to the frequencies used at this distant base and plug them into the radios. I mean, you know, today you can dial up any frequency you want to because it's done electronically. No, it was, looking back, it seems silly and I wonder that we ever achieved anything, I suppose.
Could you give me a thumbnail sketch of the Hunter? I know you've mentioned some aspects of it, but if you could give me a kind of...
Well, I've got two points of view of the Hunter. Of course, I've got one as a Hunter fighter pilot in Germany in 1958 and 9, and the other as a trained test pilot who has now been taught how to assess aeroplanes. And I make myself extremely unpopular these days when I say that I think the Hunter was a terrible aeroplane, because it meets none of the standards. I'm talking to the flying machine now. We've dismissed the equipment fitment as that's different, but the flying machine, in my view, had poor handling qualities. It lacked a reasonable aileron trimmer and one that was effective. You had to keep your hand on the stick, basically. If you took your hand off the stick and left the airplane to its own devices for a bit, it was going to go rolling off or pitching off in one direction or another for a bit. The aircraft was not particularly stable in that regard. There was a thing that when people first took off in Hunter, they were said to wave bye-bye. Well, what that meant was that the wings were rocking. Left, right, left, right, left, right, because they were trying to get used to these very sensitive ailerons. It wasn't until I was on the Empire Test Pilot School course and I was given a Javelin to fly for my final preview test. I took off in this Javelin, which I'd never flown before, of course, and instantly this thing felt solid as a rock in you know, 2 feet above the runway. And I thought, whoa, this is super, this is a stable aeroplane, you know, it just sits there. The Hunter was a twitchy thing. Now, people say, well, I like an aircraft to be light and twitchy and sensitive. Well, it depends on your point of view, you know. The Hunter, however, was an extremely exciting aeroplane to fly. And as a fighter pilot, I mean, the acceleration it had, the rate of climb it had, the high speed it had, the way you could pull G, the way you could roar up and down and roll and do aerobatics, of course, wonderful. But if you're a trained evaluator whose job is to say, is this thing the best we can produce for a fighter pilot to do his job with, then with modern, and with hindsight, you know, all good stuff that is, I think it was a load of rubbish, but that's an exaggeration. Its flying qualities left quite a bit to be desired. In test pilot parlance, the squadron pilot had to compensate for the aeroplane's limitations and design deficiencies. Service pilots are very good at compensating for an aircraft's deficiencies. You ask any service pilot, and that even goes today, what do you think of your airplane? It's the best one in the world, you know. A service pilot will always say, it's part of this competitive thing, you know, mine's the best thing in the world. And they may actually believe it. I don't know, but they certainly say it and always have done, and that's the service culture. It isn't always literally accurate from an engineering and a subjective point of view, I suppose, is I'm sorry, we're wandering off the point, but you see what I mean. There are two different points of view: the engineering test pilot or the squadron operator. The squadron operators fly airplanes better than test pilots, much better, because they're doing it all the time and they fly the same airplane day after day, month after month, and they get very good at coping with its deficiencies. They don't even realize they are. The test pilot jumped in and out of all sorts of different aeroplanes. He's never really got up to speed on any one of them. I mean, when I was at Bedford, I was flying 20 aeroplanes a month, different types a month, you know. And some of them you'd only fly once or twice a year. Well, don't tell me you're flying it properly, because you're not. I'm jumping away from the topic there, but you have to accept that when you ask somebody what they think of an aeroplane and what it was like, their point of view will depend on what they say. And the operator's point of view is very different from the evaluator's and test pilot's point of view.
You mentioned its handling qualities. Did it have any vices, anything that it would do that would be dangerous or threatening?
Yes, I mean, it had... It used to suffer from the occasional hydraulic failure and had to be recovered in manual control. And it was very difficult to fly manually. And because the ailerons and elevators and tailplane were so heavy, we're talking two hands, and it wasn't stable, and it would have a Dutch roll motion where you rolled and the nose wandered from side to side and the wings rocked up and down, and it was quite difficult to do a manual landing, and you used to have to do one a month or something to stay current in the case of a hydraulic failure. So yes, that was a deficiency, but arguably outside the operational range of the airplane. When it came to having all your flying controls, I suppose its main deficiency was that it would pitch up at low speed. If you flew it in combat and just went chasing after the other guy over your shoulder, pulling tighter and tighter, you could finish up what they call departing it. What it means is departing from controlled flight. The aeroplane would pitch up, and even if you stuffed the stick forward, it would just continue for the nose to come up, and up in the sense of up towards the pilot. If you're upside down, that means the nose is going down. If you're in a 90-degree bank, it means your turn's tightening. But it would pitch up and go out of control and then possibly stall and occasionally spin. People used to get into accidental spins in aeroplanes. So, yes, it was an aircraft where the pilot had to keep not just half an eye, but a pretty serious amount of his workload had to be retained to make sure he didn't lose control of the aeroplane at low speed while he's in combat.
Could you get out of a spin in a Hunter?
If you knew what to do, yes. As it happened, I later got the Hunter as an aeroplane to do my spinning in the Empire Test Pilot School. The services were not cleared to spin. You were taught the recovery technique by reading it in a book. There was a white dot painted on the instrument panel, and you pushed the stick towards that white dot, and that was part of the process of recovering from a spin. You put on opposite rudder to the turn needle, and you push the stick forward towards the white dot until it recovered, and then you centralise the controls. And this white dot was there because the lateral position, the amount of left-right that you got on the stick, was extremely critical. If you had the slightest bit of what they call outspin aileron, which is the instinctive thing when an aeroplane is rotating in a spin, it's very easy for the pilot to use the controls instinctively to try and stop it doing whatever it's doing. That's the wrong thing to do. And the only way to stop this outspin aileron creeping in was to give the pilots an aiming point, and it was a white dot painted literally on the instrument panel. You stuff it towards them. Aeroplanes did spin in, people did bail out. I won't say it was very common. I certainly don't think they lost many Hunters, because by and large, most people didn't lose control at low speed. They would sooner have lost the fight, which was always a peacetime fight in my Air Force. They would sooner have lost the fight than finish up in a spin. If we had ever finished up fighting the Russian fighters of the day in combat with the Russian, I dare say we would have lost quite a lot of aeroplanes from low speed, because you'd have had to have, well, not would have had to have, you would instinctively have given more of your mental capacity over to the enemy and dealing with him and looking for him and pulling towards him and that sort of thing, and people would have got 50 or 100 knots slower than they should have been, and lost control of their aeroplane. But that's just me guessing,
You used the term Dutch roll. Could you explain to me what that means?
There are three axes that we use to describe the motion of an airplane. It's the pitch axis, where the nose goes up or down and the airplane is climbing or diving. There's the roll axis, where your wing tip goes down on the left-hand side, you're rolling towards the left, or your wing tip goes down on the right-hand side, you're rolling towards the right. And that's called bank or roll. And then there is the directional axis, where the nose moves slightly to the left or slightly to the right without any change of bank angle, a sort of directional wandering, as it were. Pitching and rolling are motions that can take place through 360 degrees. Yawing is normally only 5 or 10 degrees at most. So a Dutch roll is a combination of yawing and rolling. There's not much yaw, but there's quite a lot of roll. And probably if you talk to modern pilots, they are more likely to talk about wing rock than they are to talk about Dutch roll. Wing rock is when the left wing goes down and then the right wing goes down and the airplane violently rocks from side to side. That's what people would call wing rock today. But Dutch roll is when the aircraft has a mixture of rolling and yawing together. Yes, it's you need to wave your hands about, don't you, to properly describe this sort of thing. There's my lovely wife wants to know something.
You're totally. You mentioned as well that when you were in the squadron, they moved from the Mark 4 to the Mark 6. What was the difference between the two aircraft, if any?
The difference between Hunter Mark 4 and Hunter Mark 6 was that the Mark 6 had a bigger Avon. It had a 200 series Avon, whereas the Hunter 4 had a 100 series Avon. Don't ask me exactly what increase of thrust that was, but it was substantial. I mean, probably 15-20% or something. So it gave it a lot more poke and a lot more performance. The 200 series Avon was a more highly developed engine in that it could cope with smoke coming out of guns being fired rather better than the 100 series. The 100 series would often stop, flame out when you fired the guns. Also, the Mark 6 Hunter had some what are called leading edge extensions, and these were small extensions to the leading edge of the wing over about the outer third or 40% of the span. They represented only, I don't know, 9 inches or something extension, and then it stopped suddenly and went straight back to the leading edge of the wing. So there was a sort of sawtooth. Sometimes people would call it a sawtooth Hunter, but if you look at any pictures of Hunter, you'll see they've either got a straight leading edge or they have a sawtooth leading edge, and the sawtooth leading edge came in the Hunter 6, and that greatly improved reduce the pitch-up tendency that I mentioned earlier at low speed. So, yes, it made the pitch handling of the aeroplane more benign. And the engine gave it more poke.
So as you were coming to the end of your tour with the squadron, what was going to be the next role? Did you have any influence on where your next posting would be at that stage?
Did I have any influence? You were always asked what you wanted to do on your annual report form. There were three slots for your first three choices of next posting, and I always used to put ETPS, ETPS, ETPS throughout my service career. And I mean, most of the officers that collected the forms didn't even know what ETPS meant. However, at the end of my Hunter tour, we had a change of squadron commander, and the man we had was himself a qualified test pilot, Reggie Spears, and he had come from a test flying squadron, a test flying job at Boscombe Down, and I told him I wanted to go to ETPS, and he agreed to put me up for that job. I didn't meet the minimum requirement, which was 750 hours minimum flying and so on, at that time, or in the Air Ministry order that specified what you had to have to apply to go to ETPS. So anyhow, he supported my application, it went in. I got to the interview, and at the end of the interview they said, you haven't got enough flying, we daren't send you off in all these different airplanes without you get some more flying, you go away, get some more flying, and you will be accepted apply again in a couple of years' time when you've got 800 or 900 hours flight, and you'll be accepted. And that is what happened. So I had to do something else after my Hunter tour. And I volunteered to go to the Central Flying School as a student to become, to learn how to become an instructor. And no RAF fighter pilot would ever be seen dead volunteering to become an instructor. I mean, not at all. But I wanted to be, because by then I was fed up with this business of pretending to be able to do an operational job on my under squadron. I'd learned how to fly a Hunter. I knew how to operate it in the weather. I learned as much as could be done about that role, and the role had so many limitations. I was fed up with playing at being a military pilot, because, you know, for the reasons we have discussed. And so I wanted to go off and be an instructor. It seemed to me to take somebody from school who only knew how to ride a bicycle and then send him solo in an aeroplane, a few weeks later, you'd achieve something. So that is what I went and did. And I did the CFS course and was very happy so to do.